Well, this is going to be exciting this morning because after spending, I think we had four messages on the Gospel of John chapter 19, we're finally in John chapter 20. And that's kind of the sign towards the end. There's only 21 chapters in the Gospel of John. And today we're going to be looking at Jesus and the fact that his tomb is empty. And this is where it starts to get really, really good. So did anyone go to the craft fair yesterday? Both of you. Thank you for supporting our community that way. That is not my favorite event. I'd rather go fishing, but yesterday, so Isaac and I went fishing, and he'll tell you this story later if you ask him. But the bottom line is we went fishing. I didn't catch anything, had a few bites. I failed. He caught three. He caught a rock bass, and then he caught a walleye, and then he caught a big mouth. Specifically, he has a picture of the big mouth. So make sure you ask him about that. So last week, we looked at this amazing picture of all of these predictions that had come true as Jesus was kind of on the cross. And so we looked at these predictions, these I don't know what you're thinking, but it's wrong. Whatever crossed your minds is not right. That was crazy. I don't know how to continue after that. I'm back on. Let's just pretend. Let's start over. Okay. So anyway, we were talking last week about all of these prophecies, predictions, and we counted, I don't know how many we covered, but there's 322 of these prophecies, these predictions that came true specifically in the life of Christ. And we looked at a whole mess of them last week where as Jesus was coming to the cross, as he was on the cross, and then even after the cross, things that he would have not had physical ability to manipulate, to fulfill, and yet all of them were fulfilled. And it was just this amazing picture. And we came to this conclusion that in order for that to happen, there has to be something significant. Jesus has to be who he said he was. And in fact, what we had is we looked at this Roman centurion who was not a Jew. He was a Gentile looking up at Christ at the cross. After all this had happened, he came to this conclusion. He himself, who did not know the law, did not know the history of it, he looks up and he says, "Surely this man was the Son of God," which was a remarkable statement, because that Roman centurion prior to that moment would have been looking at Caesar and known and grown up with Caesar is, in a sense, God, or Caesar is, in a sense, the Son of God. And yet something there switched in this guy's mind is like, wow, there's something different about this Jesus on the cross. Everything here that I've just witnessed, and we see him proclaim then that this Christ, is there something different about him, that he is, in fact, the Son of God. So this last week, I went in for a chest scan, and I learned something with the chest scan. So I went in because I was having some rib pain, couldn't really figure out what it was, but I go in for the chest scan, and the report that the doctor gave back to me was basically, here in a nutshell, what's going on is you're getting old. He said, everything looks good, you're just old, and there's some few things showing up there, but that happens when people get old. These are literally some of the things that he kind of kept saying to me. He's like, thank you for that. I really feel better. I don't know if I should have gone in for the chest scan or not. I don't know if I feel better or worse. But what's interesting is I came across this week, there was this study done in 2013 in which they had given a number of these radiologists, I don't remember the exact number, but they give a number of these radiologists a series of chest scans in which these radiologists are supposed to look at these chest scans, specifically trying to spot cancer. And so this is, in a sense, what they're viewed, okay? And what they're looking for is these little dots, kind of like that one there and such, that would be signs that maybe there's a cancer developing. And so as they did this, they incorporated, so this scan layer, as they're working down this person, they're looking for these little dots. And so these radiologists are trained to scrutinize these images. And yet what's fascinating is 84% of these radiologists that are scrutinizing these images, which contained this little gorilla, 84% of them missed it. And they're trained to scrutinize these images. So the test was, the study was, to kind of weigh and gauge people as what they're looking for. Are they seeing what's really there? Are we so focused on and bent on seeing only what we want to see, only see what's kind of what we think is in front of us, and missing the bigger picture? And what we're going to see this morning is we have this story of some of the disciples. And we have this story of Mary Magdalene in particular, what we're going to spend most of the time on. And she's there at this tomb. We're going to watch her at this empty tomb. And yet here she is, and she should have some of these signs. She should be knowing what she's looking for. And yet she's so focused. She's so stuck on what it is that she's supposed to be scrutinizing. She misses the fact that Jesus is standing right there in front of her, right before her eyes. Just like that gorilla on the screen is right before these radiologists' eyes, and they're trying to scan it, and they're missing it. So did Mary also miss it, but then Jesus makes sure she doesn't miss it for very long. And so, we have some cool stuff that we are going to look at here. A couple things as we get started. Remember that when Jesus was put into this tomb, it was Joseph of Arimathea. He was one of the members of the Sanhedrin. He was a wealthy man, brand new tomb, significant of that because it's basically Christ would go into this new tomb, signifying that this now is part of this grave, this cemetery, this tomb that symbolizes this new family. That's really a key and crucial piece of the puzzle. But what's even more so interesting is the Gentiles, the non-Jews, as well as the Jewish leaders, all of them kind of grasped a little bit of what Jesus was saying in his cryptic language, saying, all right, didn't he say that he was going to rise again in 3 days? And so they wanted to take precautions of that. They didn't want the disciples to steal his body and then claim that Jesus Christ was risen. They didn't want that. And so they put guards at the tomb. So they took issue and put some protections in place so that some of those false accusations couldn't be made, which is just remarkable when we see what will happen here this morning. So some of the evidence that Jesus was, and again, this goes to kind of what we were talking about last week, evidences that point to the fact that Jesus was supposed to raise from the dead. So in Psalm 16, verse 10, you find it, this is what it says, because you, this is God, you will not abandon me to the realm of the dead, nor will you let your faithful one see decay. This was believed to be pointing, prophesying the fact that this Savior would not die and stay dead, if you will. Hosea 6:2, after 2 days he will revive us, on the third day he will restore us, that we may live in his presence. This was prophesied towards Israel, but again, when we see a lot of these prophecies that we find in the Old Testament and New Testament, many of those prophecies were intended at that time and also to reflect a bigger picture that which was coming. We see some in the New Testament. Now, this is Jesus saying this about himself, but no, this was said after he rose from the grave, and he's pointing back to some of these other things. And he says, he told them, Jesus, this is what is written. The Messiah will suffer and rise from the dead on the third day. Well, that's easy to say because you already did that. That was, after the fact. I don't know if that's true. However, we find in Mark chapter 10, this was said before he was suffered and died and crucified and buried. So in Mark 10, verse 33 and 34, it says this, Jesus is telling this to his disciples, we are going up to Jerusalem, he said, and, note, while we are there, the Son of Man, who is himself, will be delivered over to the chief priests and the teachers of the law. They will condemn him to death and will hand him over to the Gentiles, who will mock him and spit on him and flog him. We looked at this, remember, a couple weeks ago, and flog him and kill him. 3 days later, he will rise. And Jesus told this to his disciples before he ever even went to Jerusalem. And what I guess I'm kind of pointing out is that the disciples should have had some idea that this was coming. And perhaps in some capacity they did, but yet we see that there's obviously a lack of faith. There's obviously a lack of belief. There's some doubt that kind of incorporates into that. And let's just be honest, that's okay. Because if we're going to be gut-level honest, every one of us struggles sometimes with faith and with doubt. And we're going to talk more about faith next week, and it's just going to be fabulous. Wonderful. So what we're looking at here then, as we start into John chapter 20, verse 1, we see right away, it says, early on the first day of the week, while it was still dark, Mary Magdalene went from the tomb. Now, it's interesting because some people will point out, hey, there's some conflict in the Gospels here because one says it just at daybreak, one says, well, it's still dark. Well, it's not really a conflict because basically what they believe that John is referring to is when they left the house, it was still dark. When they got to the tomb, daybreak. It's not that complicated really to talk about what's actually going on. So on the first day of the week, while it was still dark, Mary Magdalene, fascinating. Do we even know who this Mary Magdalene is? We know very little about her. We don't actually even have an account of who she even is unless we look back at Luke chapter 8. In Luke chapter 8, verse 2, it's about the only point we get reference to her. There's one in Matthew, but it's actually looking retrospect as well, kind of at the time where Mary was at the tomb. Matthew takes and points back to who this Mary was, and this is, in a sense, what the event that he's pointing back to. So in Luke chapter 8, verse 2, this is about the only record we have of Mary Magdalene. And it says, and also some women who had been cured of evil spirits and diseases, Mary, called Magdalene, from whom seven demons had come out. And this is pretty astounding. When you look at, here's Jesus Christ. He's about ready to be raised. We know the story for the most part, and so I'm kind of jumping ahead a little bit because we kind of know it's not going to be a surprise ending here, all right? Jesus raises from the grave. The tomb is empty. Sorry, that was a spoiler. If you were like, wow, what's going to happen? What's going to happen? That's what happens, all right? So now that we know that that's going to happen, we can look back on this a little bit and look at this. Okay, let's analyze it a little bit. So here you have Mary Magdalene. She's the first one that Jesus appears to. He's got 12 disciples who he spent the last 3 years with. Wouldn't it make more sense that he would appear before one of the 12? You know, because they're the ones that were with him this whole time, and yet he doesn't. And I think there's something significant here. I know that there's some in the Catholic Church who believe that it was first to Mary, the mother of Jesus. There's not scriptural evidence for it. Okay, so that's church tradition. I'm not trying to shoot anyone down, but the reality of it is what we're looking at with the scriptures, this is the person who we see who Jesus first appeared to. Now, there's some misunderstandings of who this Mary was. Many believe that she was a prostitute. It's possible that this Mary Magdalene was a prostitute. Mary came from an area called Magdala. That's why she's Mary of Magdalene. Magdala would have been, if you're familiar with your New Testament kind of geography and history, you had, remember, that Jordan River's up to the Sea of Galilee. Up at the top, you have Capernaum, and just about 3 miles down and to slightly to the west, on the west bank of the Sea of Galilee, you have Magdala. Magdala was known for its kind of its rudimentary textile industry, and maybe even more so by its fishing industry. It was believed that they had a large number of fish that would come in, but they were mostly sardines, and so that was kind of their big way of income. There's some areas and most cities that would have been strongly poor, some that would have been fairly wealthy. It's believed that Mary maybe was one or the other. You know what that means? We don't know. That's what really bottom line it means. And so we don't want to necessarily throw some things in there. There's some speculation by read from Dawson McAllister. He believes that Magdala, when it says Mary of Magdalene or from Magdala, that it actually was referring to in a literal translation as one who had braided hair. And what's interesting in the Jewish culture at certain points, if you had your hair braided, it was actually the only people that ever braided their hair at that time in history would have been those who were, what do you call it, basic sinners, okay? They were looked at as being, sorry, you don't do that. Now, again, I looked for strong evidence, didn't find strong evidence. That's coming from Dawson McAllister. If that's the case, what it is signifying is it's Mary with the braided hair, Mary the one who is promiscuous, Mary the one who is a sinner. We don't know a lot of those things. But what we do know from this one simple verse, and we look at it here, it says, Mary called Magdalene, that's where she came from whom seven demons came out. So what we can assess, demons are not going to be leading Mary into a life of righteousness. Okay, there's no way why we would make that assumption. If you have filled with seven demons, you know what temptation when you're driving down the road and someone cuts you off and you either want to point to the sky or you want to cut them off again. You know that kind of that stirrings that you have. That's kind of a little bit of what we're talking about. But we're looking at seven demons here. Lust and greed and hatred and envy and all of these things probably permeated her. Could prostitution and promiscuity? Absolutely, it could have. We don't know though. But the reality of it is when you're possessed by seven demons, there's no way she is living even close to a righteous life. She is living a life of not only sin, but depravity and hurt and pain. And she's causing hurt and she's causing pain. And this is a life that she is living that is just like death would be better. You understand what I'm saying? And what's interesting is we look at this, and now it was confused by some speakers in the past, and this is not the same person. However, I'm pointing this out because I do believe what is said here about this Mary would also point to a truth about Mary Magdalene. So this is what it said. This is a different Mary. This is a Mary that as Jesus went in, this woman was crying her tears and wiping Jesus' feet. Okay? So when Jesus came in, they're going to have supper, and here comes this woman, and she's basically a prostitute. It says so. And she's basically weeping over Jesus' feet. She's crying her tears on him and then wiping off his feet, almost like washing his feet with her tears, and then takes her hair and then starts drying the feet. And the disciples look at this like, what's wrong with you? Get out of here. That is just gross. It's just nasty. What? You don't do that. And Jesus rebukes him and says, you have no idea. And then what he goes on, he says this, she loves me so much because she has been forgiven of so much. So this is what it says. She was forgiven many, many sins. This woman at Jesus' feet. Not Mary Magdalene. We're not the same person. But again, I'm saying the same thing could be said about both Marys. Okay? Because, again, the seven demon thing. So she was forgiven many, many sins. And so she is very, very grateful. And that's where some versions will say she has forgiven much, and so then she has the capacity to love much. And then the opposite then is also true. If the forgiveness is minimal, the gratitude is minimal. In other words, if you haven't been forgiven much, if you've been forgiven little, some versions say, you love little. And that right there gives us this picture of who this Mary Magdalene is, because she is the one that is standing outside of this tomb of Jesus Christ. Why is she even there? Is she there just to make sure people see that she's there? No, she's there because she loved this man, and she loved him so much because he cast out seven demons that were inside possessing her. He revolutionized her life. He totally changed her life. And because of that fact, because of all that she had been forgiven, she has the capacity to love very deeply. If you look at people, I believe, who really have the capacity to love people deeply, I think they have somehow come to the realization that they have been forgiven of a great deal of wrongdoings. The most loving people you'll find are probably some of the ones that had been the most broken. That's astounding. Let's keep that in mind as we go through this. So here we go. Back to the Gospel of John, chapter 20, verse 2. Now that we know a little bit more about this Mary Magdalene, we can enter in here. So here we have, so Mary, we didn't quite finish that one, did we? Sorry about that. We only got halfway through the verse. If you're playing Ryan Bingo, that would be a square. So she was forgiven many, many sins, and so she is very, very grateful. I've got to go way back. I'm sorry. Hang tight with me. I'm there. There we go. So Mary Magdalene went to the tomb, and she saw that the stone had been removed from the entrance. Now, that would not have been normal, okay? Once that stone is there, it stays there. So she sees that the stone has been removed away. All right, now we're going ahead. There we go. So she came running. She sees that the tomb is empty. The stone's been removed. There's no one in the tomb. This is kind of a big deal, all right? What was once there, what is supposed to be there, is missing. It's not there. I am going to go tell those authorities, those who are also teachers, I feel, those who have been with Jesus these last 3 years, I'm going to let them know because I think they may have a little bit more idea of what's going on than I do. So she came running to Simon Peter and to the other disciple, the one that Jesus loved, and said, they have taken the Lord out of the tomb and we don't know where they have put him. Okay. Now it's interesting. You look at Mary's language here. Basically what it is believed that she's getting at is they, in a sense, is either Joseph or Arimathea, like it changed his mind. And no, I'd really rather not Jesus have my tomb. That was temporary. And they've moved him to somewhere else because that was Joseph's tomb. Or we don't know what else. But she doesn't necessarily look at they have stolen him as much as they have moved him in this language. And so she comes running. She says, they've taken Jesus. They've taken the Lord. I love the way that she says they have taken the Lord out. And she uses that phrase several times as far as the Lord, calling him Lord. Even in his death, she still sees Jesus as Lord. And we don't know where they have put them. Okay, the we there is she was with other women. All right, we see that in the other accounts of the gospel, just to be clear. So Peter and the other disciples started for the tomb. Okay, they began running. Both were running, but the other disciple outran Peter. So if you're going to put together your track team, who are you picking, Peter or John? John. Right? Okay. But if you want someone to cross the finish line, who are you going to pick? Peter. Because watch. But the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first. And here it is. So John then bends over, because this is not like a full doorway such. He bends over. The tomb is, stone is rolled away. He bends over and he looks inside the tomb. And what does he see there? He sees the strips of linen lying there, but he did not go in. So he stopped short. We don't really know why. But it's very interesting when you look at how John's the author of this. He's writing in the sense first person narrative where he sees this happening, but refers to himself in the third person. But he's writing down what he witnessed. And we're also going to see he writes down what he believed. And it's really astounding because he gets very vulnerable. So he looks in. He sees the linen lying there, but did not go in. Then Simon Peter, who came after, because he was slower. He was also older, so younger people are faster runners by nature. At a point, you know, when I was doing youth ministry, I could outrun most of the kids for a while, and then I just decided to stop trying because it's not worth the sore muscles and the injuries. So then Simon Peter came along behind him and went straight into the tomb. He didn't hesitate. He crossed that finish line. He goes straight into the tomb. And he saw the strips lying there. So this is what they see. They see the linens that Jesus had been wrapped in. Remember, we talked about it last week, 75 pounds. Okay, Ted Fusi came up to me last week and said, hey, my Bible says 100 pounds. But he did correct me. He said, but I read the text note and said that was based on 12 ounces. I don't know why that is, but whatever. Roughly 75 pounds, maybe 100 pounds. Doesn't really make any difference. A lot of this linen and burial spices, okay? Quite a bit was there. Now, interesting, Jesus didn't need to unwrap himself to free himself. Okay, we see evidence of that thereafter. We're going to see it next week when they have a room, it's specified that's locked, and boom, Jesus is inside the room. You know, he is now the capacity. He can be anywhere he wants to be, anytime. You can lock him out. Doesn't matter. He'll still get in. All right, there's a story there too, but well, different day. So then Simon Peter came along behind him and went straight into the tomb. He saw the strips of linen. They're still lying there. That's important to note. As well as this cloth, they have this head cloth that would also then cover the body that had been wrapped around Jesus' head. The cloth was still lying in its place, separate from the other linen. Finally, the other disciple who had reached the tomb first also went inside. And this is what it says, and this is a little bit confusing, and we'll talk more about this next week. It says, he saw and he believed. But he also said, and this is that vulnerability point, he says, but they, John referring to himself as well as Peter, they still did not understand from the scriptures that Jesus had to raise from the dead. There was still something missing in their faith, in their belief. They believed something was happening. And why did they believe it? They believed that Jesus was not stolen. I mean, I think that's a big part of it because the cloths were still there. If someone's coming in to steal the body, they're rolling away the stone, they're taking Jesus in the body, they're not going to spend time unwrapping it, and there was no evidence that he was unwrapped. And in fact, some versions refer to this head cloth was actually rolled and or folded and laid neatly. There's no urgency taking place here whatsoever. There's no evidence of theft in this fact that Jesus was stolen. It's just not there. And so that's what we'll see, that view was circulated by some of the Jewish leaders. Let's just say the disciples stole him. And that was a view that would be circulated for quite some time. But the evidence does not point to that. The evidence points to something else. And so something significant is happening here. They, John says, believed, but yet watch what they do then. Do they go and say, Jesus is risen, Jesus is risen, we believe? They don't do that. They go back where? Back to their locked room. So it says, then the disciples went back to where they were staying, which was a room together by themselves, fearful of the government, fearful of the Jews, fearful that maybe their lives would be at stake if they ever proclaimed anything. And that fear will be washed away eventually. But at this point, they're back there. It says they believe, but what do they believe? We don't know. And now watch what happens. So Mary stayed back. She stayed. Remember, she went and got Peter and John. They come running. So Mary's back there. Peter and John have left. And here's Mary, and it says that she's weeping. She's outside the tomb crying. It's interesting to note, you know, scientifically, there's not really a purpose for crying. You know, these tears have a purpose because they lubricate the eyes and they can wash out, you know, impurity. But for the most part, scientifically, there's like no reason why we would need to cry. It is something that God has given for us. And so, men, it's okay to cry because God gave it to you. All right. And so this idea of crying, and here's Mary, she's crying, and God will, you're going to see that God recognizes that is good. He doesn't chastise her. We'll see more of that. It's just wonderful. So here is Mary. She's crying. And as she wept, she bent over and she looked inside the tomb. Now, we don't have evidence of her going in with Peter and John. And so what she sees there may have taken her by surprise, but in the same capacity, these guys may have already been there. We don't necessarily know. But what she finds is she sees two angels in white. They're sitting there. Where'd these guys come from? We don't know. All right. They suddenly appeared. Were they in there when Peter and John were in there? I don't think so. It's not evidence. I think if John was writing this and saw them, I think he would have written it down at this time. But here, so Mary looks in, John left, and Mary looks in and she sees these two guys in white. And it's, look at where they're sitting. They're sitting where Jesus had been. So they're proving that, again, Jesus is not here. I'm sitting where he would have been. I couldn't sit here if Jesus were here. So at one head, one at the head and one other at the foot. And they asked her, I love this. They don't say, Mary, stop your blabbering. They don't say, Mary, stop crying. Jesus is alive. Suck it up. They don't go there. Instead, they say, woman, why are you crying? We recognize your pain. We recognize your hurt. And she says, she responds. You know, she must not know that they're angels at the time, because I think her reaction would be different. But she ends up saying, they have taken my Lord away. Again, there's that phrase, they have taken my Lord. Even in his death, Jesus is her Lord. They have taken my Lord away, she said, and I don't know where they put him. Again, this is pointing out that she believes that either Joseph or some of his workers, whatever, have taken Jesus, they've put him somewhere else. Listen, all I want to do is bring him back, okay? That's really all I want. I'm heartbroken, I'm torn. At this, she turned around. So something must have triggered. Either she, you know, somehow someone comes behind you, you kind of sense that someone's there. It's like, wait, what are you doing? Or maybe she saw the angel's eyes and the angel's eyes looked up past her shoulder and she recognized that someone was standing behind her. So she turns and she sees, and this is what she finds. She turned around and she saw Jesus standing there, but she did not realize that is who it was. She did not realize it was Jesus. And he asks her the same question. He says, woman, why are you crying? And then I love this. Look at this. Who is it you're looking for? That is significant. I'm going to mess things up here again because I'm going to go with some slides and I'm going to forget and have to come back. So in John chapter 1, if you remember when Jesus was first, okay, baptized, you have John the Baptist, and he's baptizing these people and some of his followers, and John's always pointing to Christ, behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. Well, some of John's own disciples end up starting to follow Jesus. And this is one of those occasions. So they're following Jesus. And as Jesus is walking away, he turns and he sees these guys. And this is what he says to him. He turns around. Jesus saw them following and he asks, what is it you want? The question in their translations are very similar. What is it you want? The other phrase could be like, who are you looking for? Which we saw again, didn't we? In John chapter 18. Jesus fully realized all that was going to happen to him. This is when he's being arrested. And so he stepped forward to meet them, and he asked these soldiers. Remember, we had these 600 soldiers, and we had these chief priests. And he says, who is it you're looking for? The question is virtually the same that he's asking Mary right now. Mary, who are you looking for? And she, thinking he's the gardener. The gardener would have been there. That would have been appropriate at that time, even on that day. No one else really except for the gardener would have made sense. And she says, sir, if you have carried him away, you're the gardener, you know what happened. If you have carried him away, tell me where you have put him, and I will go get him. And then Jesus says to her, he calls her by name, and says, Mary. She turned towards him, and she cried out. She recognized it in Aramaic, Rabboni, which means teacher. In some versions, we like to refer to it, that means beloved or loved teacher. And that also reminds me of what we see in John chapter 10. Look at this. Remember this way back? Jesus refers to himself as the gatekeeper and the good shepherd. He says, the gatekeeper opens the gate for him, and the sheep listen to his voice. He calls his own sheep by name, and he leads them out. And when he has brought out all of his own, he goes on ahead of them, and his sheep follow him because they know his voice. Mary did not recognize Jesus until he spoke her name. And this is the image that came to my mind as I'm looking at this. It's like, that is a picture right there of Jesus being that good shepherd. He knows Mary by name. He calls her by name. She recognizes, as a sheep, she recognizes the voice of the good shepherd, and she says, Rabbi, it's you. Isn't that remarkable? She turned, she cried out in Aramaic, Rabboni, which means teacher. And Jesus, so she clings to him. Did I go too far? So she clings to him. We have this image where she clings to Jesus. In a sense, you'd basically be grabbing onto his feet. If you remember when Lazarus was raised from the dead, remember this that story? So you have Mary and Martha, different Mary, lots of Marys in the Bible, okay? So you have Mary and Martha, and their brother Lazarus died, and so they buried him, similar to what we have here, and Jesus stands at the tomb 4 days later after, you know, he's starting to stink, and he calls Lazarus to come forth. He comes forth, there he is, and wrapped up in these grave clothes, and what does he say? Take off the grave clothes. He doesn't need them any longer. What did we see with Jesus? He left the grave clothes. Are they necessary? No. Grave clothes are for who? They're for the dead. Jesus is not dead. And even more so than what we have is after Lazarus had come forth, you know, they, in a sense, would cling to him. It's like, I can't believe you're alive. You're back with us again. And what Jesus is saying, we get confused here. He says, do not hold on to me, for I have not yet ascended to the Father. He's looking at, why would you rebuke her that way? It's like, come on, give her some grace here. I think really the message that Jesus is saying is, it's not exactly what you think, Mary. I'm not here to stay as I was. Things are not going back the way that they were. Everything has changed. And it's changed for the better. So he says, do not hold on to me, for I have not yet ascended to the Father. Go instead to my brothers and tell them, I am ascending to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God. Mary Magdalene then went to the disciples with the news, I have seen the Lord. And she told them that he had said these things to her. And Mary, at that moment, became, if you will, the apostle to the apostles, the messenger who had seen Christ. And isn't it remarkable when you have a woman so steeped in sin, forgiven of so much, comes to love more deeply than perhaps anyone we've ever really encountered? And that's kind of where we're left with. You know, I came across a quote this last week from A.W. Tozer. And this is what it says, and this is kind of then how I understood it. It said, when you read your New Testament and you realize afresh, which is this New Testament stuff we're looking at, and you realize afresh the attitudes, I love that word, the attitudes and the utterances, not only what how Jesus treats people with his attitude, but also what he says, and this is what we have the evidence of what he says, when you realize afresh the attitudes and utterances of our Lord Jesus Christ, you know exactly how God feels. And when we look at how Jesus treats Mary, what compassion, what love, what grace. And then we can know full well that that is exactly how God feels then about us. We're going to transition into a time of celebrating the Lord's table. And what a better way to do it, because we get to engage with this fact of everything here symbolizes the deep love that he has for us. And so here's what I'm asking. You know, we talk about owning our own depravity and such. That's crucial. Because I don't think Mary would have loved Jesus as much as she loved him if she hadn't come to the realization of how desperately she needed forgiveness. And when she came to that realization, I need his forgiveness so much, and then she got it, she was filled with such deep, passionate love. And that was evidenced in what we looked at this morning. And so we're going to, I'm going to invite Pete Ring to come up, one of our elders, and he's going to help me up here. And then Greg Horsch is going to help in the back. But we're going to invite you again to come forward. And as you come forward, I want to envision you to envision, if you will, this idea you're approaching Christ. You know, we have the cross still set up there. You're approaching Christ, knowing full well of how unworthy you are of forgiveness, and yet he's forgiven you of it.